Program's not done yet because we're going to enter into phase two of our program. If you've been interested in what you've heard from Dr. Gary Habermas, this will be posted on the website. You can find it at conversewithscholars.org, and that'll be a redirect to Reclaiming the Mind Ministries, and we'll have this entire discussion posted. As well, we want to mention a book that Gary Habermas has authored along with Mike Lacona called The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus. You can find that on our website. You can find that through Amazon or a variety of sources. But that'll give you some good background work into the necessary evidence that goes along with these types of discussions. We thank you for your time. We recognize, Gary, that I know you need to carry on, and so we appreciate you. What we're going to do now, folks, is introduce our three panel guests. And we're going to carry on for another hour as we talk about some more details and get some more perspective from three different scholars who are joining us. It's our privilege to introduce again to Converse with Scholars, Mike Lacona. Mike is a New Testament historian specializing in the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. Mike is the Director of Apologetics and the Interfaith Evangelism at the North American Mission Board of the Southern Baptist Convention. Mike was just recently on Converse with Scholars talking about a book he recently wrote and published called Paul Meets Muhammad, A Christian-Muslim Debate on the Resurrection. And again, that book also provides some very helpful information. Again, a new book that Mike has just recently authored. So, Mike, we welcome you. Along with Mike, we have Robert Bowman. He has authored many books. He's an award-winning author, as a matter of fact, of about a dozen books and a couple dozen articles. He's the manager of Apologetics, the Interfaith Evangelism of the North American Mission Board. He's currently writing a book to be published by Kriegel later this year on the Talpiot Tomb. So, Robert, we certainly welcome you. You're also no stranger to Converse with Scholars. I'm going to turn it over to you in just a moment. But I'll also introduce our third scholar, Dr. Daniel Wallace, is with us, a professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary and director for the Center of the Study of New Testament Manuscripts. Dan is also the senior New Testament editor of the Net Bible. And numerous publications, including Reinventing Jesus and Dethroning Jesus, which is coming soon. So, Dan, we welcome you as well. It's a privilege because Dan's actually sitting right beside me here, and we're working on this together. So our three guests again, Mike Lacona, Robert Bowman, and Dan Wallace, we welcome all three. And, Robert, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you maybe engage a little. Maybe you want to comment just a moment on Gary Habermas's presentation and help us dive in as we continue on to discuss this project together.
Terrific. Thanks for the opportunity to participate in this great discussion. I'd like to do a little shorter overview of what we've just been listening to from Dr. Habermas, and specifically I want to look at these six names that are involved in this particular tomb, the Talpiot Tomb. By the way, for those who are wondering what Talpiot means, that's basically it's a neighborhood or a suburb in Jerusalem where this particular tomb was found. And what we're going to do is just briefly look at each of these six ossuaries. Again, ossuary is a bone box where after the body had completely decomposed, they would place these bones, the bones of the deceased, within this box, typically constructed out of limestone with a lid that would cover the interior of the box, and they would sometimes scratch a person's name on the outside of the box. And there are six of these boxes in that were discovered in this particular tomb that had names scratched on them, and these are the basis for the particular interest in this tomb. So let me talk about these six names very quickly, and then bring Mike and Dan into the discussion as well. The most significant name here, really, for the purposes of what we're talking about, of course, would be the ossuary with the name Yeshua Bar Yosef, Jesus, son of Joseph, and this is the cornerstone name out of the six names that has to be taken into consideration in assessing this claim, that this is in fact the family tomb of Jesus, the tomb having bone boxes or ossuaries from Jesus and other family members. Now, the name Jesus, son of Joseph, that name itself would be a pretty common name. There were lots of Jesuses and lots of Josephs, as Dr. Habermas explained. But there wouldn't be, necessarily that many who had that were Jesus, son of Joseph, and that had a Mary in the family and another Joseph and so forth and so on. And that's the argument that the folks make in this particular documentary of the Discovery Channel, is they're claiming that when you get all these names together, you have a unique case for this being the Jesus family tomb. Now, before we look at these six names, I just want to make an observation as to the inconsistency in the methodology. The whole argument for this particular conclusion that this is the Jesus family tomb depends entirely on correlating the names on the ossuaries with the historical background information that we have about the individuals that are supposed to be either Jesus or persons related to Jesus. In other words, we have certain historical sources of information, various writings that came that were produced in the first century and thereafter that refer to Jesus, that refer to Mary, that refer to Mary Magdalene, and so on. And we are told basically the argument for correlating Jesus and his family with this particular tomb is that you can supposedly correlate the historical information from outside the tomb, from these writings, with the inscriptions on the ossuaries. That's the entirety of the case. If you can't do that, if they do not correlate well, then there's no case. And that's what people need to understand. There is no other line of argument for concluding that this is the Jesus family tomb other than alleging that there is a strong correlation between the names on the boxes, the names on the ossuaries, and the background information that we already have from other sources about Jesus and his family. Now, when we actually look at the names, we'll see that there is no such wonderful correlation. In fact, the correlation breaks down on a number of points. The second most important name on these ossuaries, besides the Jesus, son of Joseph name, would be the name that is commonly, conventionally interpreted as saying Mariamne e Mara, which is Mary, also known as Mara, is how it has usually been read. Now, the claim that they make in the documentary is that Mariamne is a very unusual spelling of Mary, and that it is found in a book called The Acts of Philip in reference to Mary Magdalene. And so, therefore, this is supposed to be evidence that Mariamne in this ossuary could be Mary Magdalene, because this unusual spelling of her name is found in this document called The Acts of Philip. Also, the term Mara, we are told in the documentary, and by the way, in the book, The Jesus Family Tomb, which is the companion to the documentary, we are told that Mara is the Aramaic word for master. And so what this is saying is the inscription on the ossuary is interpreted to mean Mary, also known as the master. Now, who would this Mary known as the master be? Well, according to the documentary, Mary Magdalene was regarded by early Christians as a teacher, an apostle, a leader among the early Christian movement, and so the title Master would be an appropriate title for her in that context. Now, the problem here, there's several problems. One is the inscriptional issue. Stephen Fann, and that's spelled P-F-A-N-N, Stephen Fann has shown that the inscription on this particular ossuary probably does not say Mariamne e Mara, that is Mary, also known as Mara. It probably says Mariamne kai Mara, which is Mary and Mara. And Mara, by the way, is commonly understood as a variant form of the name Martha, so that what the inscription probably says is Mary and Martha. No, this wouldn't be the sisters of Lazarus. There is no Eleazar or Lazarus in this tomb, and those are extremely common names. And it was apparently fairly common for sisters to be named Mary and Martha. That was apparently a fairly common pairing of names. But in any case, Mary and Martha, obviously, that particular combination of names on this inscription ruins the theory that this is Mary Magdalene. But there are other problems besides the inscription. There are historical problems. The Acts of Philip is a 4th century document. That is, it dates from 3 centuries after the New Testament. It is therefore not a particularly helpful source to get at information about the historical Mary Magdalene. Worse still, there is no evidence that the Acts of Philip, when it talks about Mariamne, is referring to Mary Magdalene. There is no evidence to correlate whatever the author means when he or whoever he might have in mind when he refers to Mariamne. We have no reason to think that he's referring to Mary Magdalene. By the way, the New Testament does not call Mary Magdalene Mariamne. It usually calls her Maria. There is a Maria in the tomb. There is an ossuary with the name Maria on it. But they're not identifying her as Mary Magdalene, even though the New Testament routinely refers to Mary Magdalene as Maria. There is no historical evidence that Mary Magdalene was ever married to Jesus, much less that she bore him a child. The Gospels report that Jesus met Mary Magdalene during his itinerant evangelistic and healing ministry that took place for approximately 3 years prior to his death. That's not enough time for Jesus and Mary Magdalene to have gotten married, had a child who was old enough to be the disciple whom Jesus loved, who is, by the way, identified by the documentary as Jesus' son. That's just historically not credible. It won't fit the gospel evidence, and there's no reason to dispute the gospel on this point, that Jesus met Mary Magdalene during his earthly ministry. In fact, according to the Gospel of Luke, Jesus cast demons out of Mary Magdalene during his itinerant ministry. The gospel certainly wouldn't have made something like that up about Mary Magdalene, who was always held in high esteem. So that is a bedrock historical fact about Mary Magdalene, that she was understood to have been demon-possessed until Jesus met her and cast a demon out of her, and that couldn't have happened until approximately 2 to 3 years before Jesus died. Now, Mary Magdalene was viewed in some high esteem, held in some high esteem by some people in the early church, even higher than what you find in the Gospels, which do hold her in high esteem. But those that give Mary Magdalene the highest place were not Jewish Christians. They were not the earliest Jewish followers of Jesus. They were 2nd and 3rd century, 4th century Gnostic heretics. Gnostics who basically took a very Greek, very Hellenized, philosophical approach to the story of Jesus and reinterpreted Jesus in those Greek philosophical ways. So the evidence historically, as well as in terms of the inscription, is just, you know, very, very much against this inscription having anything to do whatsoever with Mary Magdalene. We could probably assign a probability of it as something like 1 in 10,000. It's that bad. Then there is an inscription referring to Judah, son of Jesus. Now, in the documentary, well, specifically in the book, the authors of the Jesus Family Tomb book decide that they are not going to assign any probability to the occurrence of this name, Judah, son of Jesus, supposedly in order to be conservative. They claim that if they took it into account, that would make it even more likely to be the Jesus Family Tomb. But that reasoning is exactly backwards. It is precisely because we have absolutely no historical evidence that Jesus had a son that we should treat the occurrence of this inscription, Judah, son of Jesus, as evidence against this being the family tomb of Jesus Christ. So, you know, whatever probability you want to assign to that, various authors who've looked at this have already said, you know, 1 in 1,000, you know, that Judah, son of Jesus, is the son of Jesus of Nazareth. At 1 in 1,000 is probably a very generous estimate. It should be much, much lower than that. Then there is an inscription on another ossuary with the name Matthew, or Matthias is the actual form used. Now, there is no Matthew in Jesus' immediate family. We have the names of all of his brothers, as well as his father, of course, his adopted father, Joseph. None of them are named Matthew. So the name Matthew on this inscription should count against this being the Jesus family tomb. Now, could it possibly be a cousin or an uncle or something like that? Yes, it's possible. But the evidence would, you know, the likelihood is that this name, if anything, should count against this being the Jesus family tomb. Then there is the name Yosa or Yose, depending on how you interpret the Aramaic text on this particular ossuary. Yosa or Yose is a nickname for Joseph. And the claim is made that this should be correlated with Jesus' brother, Joses, or Yoses, as he is named in Mark chapter 6, verse 3. But Yoses is simply a nickname for Joseph, and a very common one. It doesn't seem to have been found on a lot of ossuaries. Maybe this is, in fact, the only ossuary, as the authors claim, with this particular nickname. But Yosef was, Yosa was a very common nickname for Joseph. And we have reference to another Joseph, to a Joseph already in the tomb. Remember the ossuary with the inscription, Jesus, son of Joseph. The simplest explanation for the occurrence of this ossuary with the name Yosa is this is a term of endearment or a nickname of endearment for that same Joseph who is the father of this Yeshua or this Jesus. So Yosa probably is the father of this Yeshua or Jesus and not his brother. Now, of course, it's possible that it's a brother, but the likelihood is that it's the same Joseph that's the father. If it is a brother of Yeshua, that would be quite consistent with the fact that people very often name children after their parents. So there wouldn't be any big surprise to find two Josephs in a family tomb. Again, Joseph was an extremely common name, right up there, one of the top, you know, most common names in that particular area and time. And so one of the mistakes that's often made, in fact, everybody seems to make this mistake when they're calculating the odds, when they're calculating the probabilities, is they assume that if you know the chances of any particular name or the percentages of a particular name and you know the percentages of another name, then the chance of both names occurring in the same context, you just multiply the two together. And that's a mistake. That's a fallacy because names tend to get clumped in clusters. People tend to name their sons after the father. If your name is Joseph, your son is more likely to be named. Now, of course, he won't necessarily be named Joseph, but he's more likely to be named Joseph than if your name is Fred. That's just the way it is. So if you have one Joseph, the odds of having another Joseph are actually higher than they would be otherwise. And this kind of factor is just not taken into account when they're calculating the percentages. And then finally, there's the ossuary with the name Maria. And it is alleged this is a very unusual spelling of the name Mary and that it's a Latin form. And therefore, since the later church referred to Mary as Maria, this is evidence that this is the Mary of who's the mother of Jesus. But this is, again, exactly backward. Maria is a very common form of the name Mary in the New Testament. Several people are named Maria. It is not used very often for Mary, the mother of Jesus, although it is used. It is most commonly used in the New Testament for Mary Magdalene. So you just cannot derive these kinds of inferences from that particular spelling. of the name. And the case for this being the Jesus Family Tomb in part rests on the fallacy that if we have that they're going to use numbers based on that particular form of a name rather than that particular name. And because people spelled names in many ways, and not necessarily always spelled the names the same way, which we see in the New Testament, you cannot derive conclusions based on that assumption. So that's just a quick overview of these six names, and then, of course, we could add the seventh name of James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus, found on an ossuary that it was not originally discovered in that tomb, as best we know, although the documentary claims that it was originally found in that tomb and then stolen or taken, and there's an argument over that particular ossuary, which we've already heard a little bit about as well. All right, so that's just a quick overview of these several different ossuaries and the issues involved there. And what I'd like to do now is to bring Dan Wallace and Mike Lacona into the discussion. Mike, we'll start with you, and why don't you share with those who are listening your observations on this subject.
Let me just talk about some of the evidence that Jesus, the historical Jesus, was single. I see three major evidences for that. The first would be 1 Corinthians 9:5. And in this passage, Paul states that he and Barnabas have the same right as the other apostles to be married. They are in the same position as apostles, so they maintain that right. As Peter, the other apostles, and the Lord's brothers, he mentions specifically. So if Jesus had been married, it seems that Paul would have only had to mention Jesus' name instead of all the others, because he would have been a perfect example. Why can't Barnabas and I be married? Hey, the Lord himself was married, but we don't hear about that. We could say that's an argument from silence, and yes, it is, and we have to be careful with arguments from silence. But in a situation where we would certainly expect someone to mention something and it's absent, then we can use it. We're justified in using it. The second evidence we can give for the historical evidence that Jesus was single is in Acts chapter 8, verses 30 through 34. Philip is talking with an officer in the Ethiopian army who happens to be a eunuch reading the writings of Isaiah. And Philip goes up to him and says, hey, do you understand what you're reading? And the eunuch says, well, how can I unless someone explains it? So he's reading a messianic passage in Isaiah, and he's reading one that says of the Messiah, who can speak of his descendants? Now, of course, this is a question that is going to be very pertinent, relevant, and of interest to a eunuch, someone without descendants. So he's asking who this refers to, and so Philip gets a chance to spend some time with him and explain that it's Jesus. So here's the Messiah. He's known in the first century as a person who has no descendants, no children. The third I'd point out is that Jesus made, when you go to the cross in John's Gospel, Jesus makes provision for his mother. He tells the beloved disciple next to him, hey, take care of your mother here. This is your mother. From this point on, Mary is your mother. Take care of her. But Mary Magdalene was there as well. And if Mary Magdalene was his wife, he made no provisions for her. That's not very very nice if she's your wife. And I guess finally I'd point out that there's no mention in the New Testament that Jesus was married. So we've seen from what Gary pointed out, there's no good evidence to show us that Jesus was married. And we have pretty decent evidence to show that Jesus was single. And insofar as this argument holds up, that there's evidence, historical evidence, that Jesus was single, this casts further doubt on the Talpiot tomb being the tomb of Jesus.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate you filling that out that way. That also was helpful. I'm just going to jump in real briefly because I want to ask Dan a couple of questions here and get him on as well. Dan, we've talked a little bit about the name Miriam. Rob's talked a little bit about that. Does that ever refer to Mary Magdalene in the New Testament? And if you can just elaborate a little more on if it doesn't, what does it do?
Yeah, I think I can answer that question. I think Rob has done a great job talking about what Stephen Fan has shown earlier this week. And let me just elaborate in a couple of directions. First of all, up until just a couple of days ago when Stephen Fan showed some parallels with some papyri from the Dead Sea area, scholars thought that this was Mariamne, and then it had after that Mara, Mara it would be the name. In other words, they were saying that this was Mariamne. That is the master, if you're going to take this as an Aramaic term. Now, frankly, there's several problems with doing that. The first problem, of course, is that this is the only ossuary in that tomb that is in Greek. And if they're going to have the word master in Greek letters, they would not write it out as Mara, because in Greek, Mara doesn't mean master. If they're going to call her a master in Greek, they would use kuria. That's the word for master in Greek for a woman, kurios for a man. And since this is the only one in Greek, one has to wonder why on earth would they say Mara in Greek letters if they really meant the Aramaic. In fact, you'd expect them to have written it in Aramaic letters or to put in the Greek word kuria if they wanted to be clear about this. But beyond that, you've got the Mariamne, which, as Rob has pointed out, was never used of Mary, any Mary, in the first century. The earliest documentation we even have for that name to refer to any of the Marys in the New Testament, perhaps, is from Hippolytus in the late second century, approximately 150 years after the time of Jesus. And we're not sure which Mary he's talking about. This is in his book, Heresies 5.7. The earliest firm reference we have to Mary Magdalene being called Mary Mariamne is in the Acts of Philip from the 4th century, an apocryphal book that no scholar gives really any historical credence to. But what Stephen Fan has discovered is that more than likely the reading here on the inscription is not Mariamne, but it's Mariamne Chi, or the word and. And what that would mean is that you've got two women buried in this ossuary. One is named Mariamne, and the other is named Mara. So two different women. Mara was a nickname in Greek for Martha, so you've got a Mary and a Martha buried there. Now, the word Mariamne never occurs in the Greek New Testament. However, it is used of Mary at the end of the first century by First Clement, who wrote his letter at about A.D. 96. But even then, the spelling for the name in First Clement is with two M's at the end instead of one M. That is, it's Mariamne with M.M. Eta is how it is, or Mumu Eta is how it is in Greek. So you've got some problems with this even as an identification for any Mary from the New Testament, but it's not an overwhelming problem. It could be some Mary, but whether it's Mary Magdalene is highly doubtful. Now, there's another issue here that I don't know inscriptions well, but I do know the Greek text, and I know manuscripts well. And what I find interesting is that if we call this Mariamne or Mara, that is the Aramaic word for master, the problem is that the way you refer to somebody in terms of a second name in Greek is you don't say or, you say the so-called. So if the inscription really were to supposed to say Mariamne, that is the master, it should be He legamene, that is the one who is called master. Then it would be He legamene curia. So there's all sorts of problems with seeing this as Mary Magdalene. And of course, if you call her Mary the master, then you've got some other connections that you have to do. And in the film, they connect so many dots that you have linked hypotheses. And if the link is broken at any weak point, then the whole thing flounders. The problem is that the chain is not very strong at any point.
Thanks for bringing clarification. Dan, since we're talking about names, I want to go back and ask you about the name Judah as the son of Jesus on one of the ossuaries. Tell us what you think about the possibilities that Jesus, if he was married, even though we've really dealt with that issue, would name his son Judah. What do you think on that?
The Hebrew name Judah was transliterated into Greek as Judas. Now, one of Jesus' brothers was named Judas, and two of his disciples were named Judas. One of them, as we know, Judas Iscariot, betrayed the Lord. The name Judas quickly became associated with betrayal of the worst kind among Christians. This is, in fact, evident in the Gospel according to Judas, which was recently published.
published the ancient document that was discovered a few years ago. In that gospel, Jesus tells Judas that he will be hated and misunderstood. It completely flips all of the historical record to turn Judas into a good guy because he betrays the body of Jesus so that he can set his spirit free. This is part of the Gnostic agenda, of course, because they were against matter and they were for the spirit. But the point is that Judas was very early on recognized as the name of the one who committed the worst betrayal in history. Now here's the problem. If this really is the tomb of Jesus of Nazareth, and if he really got married to Mary Magdalene, is it likely that they would name their child Judas? I can see the conversation now. Jesus, I'm with child. I'd like to name him Judas. What do you think? That's not such a good idea. How about we name the kid Michael? In Jewish tradition, the father named the child. So this is doubly troublesome for Jesus to name this baby Judas. Now, we've got two issues here. Again, assuming that Jesus and Mary were secretly married, just for the sake of argument, would they name their child Judas? First, they would almost certainly not do this after Jesus knew who would betray him. John 6:70 says that he knew that one of the disciples would betray him, but it doesn't say that he knew which one. But if the baby was born after the crucifixion, it is extremely doubtful that it would be named after Jesus' betrayer. Second, if the baby was born before the crucifixion, then this means that Jesus and Mary were married for quite some time. Now, how is it possible for them to be married secretly for at least 9 months with the disciples not knowing about this? The film suggests that the boy Judas was a pre-teenager when Jesus was crucified. This suggests that Jesus and Mary would have been secretly married for several years, long before he even chose his disciples. And in the book, they even argue that he was there at the Last Supper. Well, the problem there you've got is, how is it possible not only for Jesus and Mary to keep it secret that he is their child, but for a child to keep it secret from these other disciples? Now, when the clear data of history are in conflict with a possible archaeological identification, and that, I would say, is at best a barely possible identification, and more evidence is coming out to suggest it's not even possible, the weaker has to give way to the stronger. Let me give this again. When the clear data of history are in conflict with a possible archaeological identification, the weaker evidence has to give way to the stronger. In this case, there simply is no real evidence to suggest that Jesus and Mary were married, as all of the speakers we've had on tonight have argued, and especially that if they were, they would have had a son named Judas.
Thanks for that, Dan. I think that really helps us understand, as you start to string the pieces together, what the real possibilities are.